Well, our passage this morning is Isaiah chapter 14 and 15. Both of these chapters talk about the country of Moab. And the key problem of Moab, as we'll see from chapter 16, verse... I just lost it. Six is pride. Pride was the downfall of Moab. Pride is something we all have issues with, isn't it? I heard that when Illinois, the state of Illinois, began offering vanity plates, 1,000 people applied for a vanity plate that says number one. 1,000 people wanted to be number one and have that emblazoned on the back of their car. Why is it that we want to be number one? We like to think of ourselves as being the best. We like to think of the way we do things as being the best way to do it. We like to think of our values as being the best, and we like to look down on everyone else who doesn't attain to us. God hates that kind of pride. In Proverbs 8, verse 13, it says, "The fear of the Lord is hatred of evil, pride and arrogance, and the way of evil and perverted speech I hate." God hates pride. And if we are proud, God will humble us, just like He did with Moab. Now let me give a little bit of orientation on the country of Moab. It's not one of the more familiar countries of the Bible. At least, I don't think of it as being real familiar. I've got a map here of the country of Israel with the Mediterranean Sea here, and Israel along here, Jerusalem right there. I guess you wouldn't be able to read anyway. I could point anywhere and you would... Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River going down here, the Dead Sea. And then on the east side, about the 60-mile distance from the bottom of the Dead Sea to the top of the Dead Sea, is the country of Moab. Across Moab, you've got a stream at the very bottom, along right about parallel with the end of the Dead Sea, called the Zered. And that formed a national boundary between Moab and Edom, which was below, south of Moab. Some of the key cities in Moab: Kir Hareseth, which is now called Al-Karak. It's kind of in the middle there. You have another stream up here, about halfway in the middle of the Dead Sea, called the Arnon River. And they have a capital city here, which is variously called the city, or Aror, or Ar. In Hebrew, the word for city is Ar, or Arim. So that's why there's some confusion whether it's called the city or whether it's called Ar. And then north of this river is, so both north and south of the Arnon River are some nice, some of the few areas where you can grow things, where there's some greenery. If you look at a satellite map of this area, and there's a little patch of green here and a little patch of green here. Not much, but a little bit. Up in the northern part, you've got a mountain, Nebo, where Moses died, or at least where he was last seen. And you've got the Heshbon. There's a little stream coming off the bottom of the Jordan River across there that waters Beth Haram, which is... mentioned in here by the second part, Harnim, and the Shirah and Heshbon are also mentioned. They're up in this area. So and Moab was famous for their vineyards, both down here around Kir Hareseth and up north around Nebo, Medeba, Heshbon, and all. They grew grapes and would make raisins out of them, press them into wine. But that was the pride of Moab. What else should I mention here? Moab started with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah are somewhere out here. Lots of people debate exactly where they are. But Lot and his wife and two daughters escaped, ran south to Zoar, which is at the very bottom of Moab, the border of Moab and Edom, the bottom of the Dead Sea. And, of course, Lot's wife didn't make it. She turned into a pillar of salt because she looked back as when God told her not to. His two daughters did make it, and her daughter's first son was named Moab. And so from him came the nation of Moab. What else? Moab also shows up in the book of Numbers. Israel has gone down into... I should mention, Lot knew that God punished sin. Lot knew Abraham closely. He knew about the one true God. And he had to pass that knowledge down to his descendants in some way. His descendants, his son Moab, had to have known that there is a God who punishes wickedness. Moab knew about God. That is perhaps why Balaam somehow knew about the one true God. When the people of Israel had gone down to Egypt and now they're coming back up, Moab didn't want them to cross through their land. The people of Moab and the king, Balak. Balak hired the prophet Balaam to curse Israel. And as Balaam tried to say these prophecies to curse Israel, the Israelites, as they're moving up into the promised land under Moses, he was not able to curse them. He only gave them blessings. And in fact, he actually delivered a messianic prophecy saying that out of that people of Israel would come a Messiah who would rule over Moab too. We see Moab show up again in... Well, okay. Again, you see this. There's rebellion here. Balak and Balaam, even though they knew this one true God was more powerful, they still rebelled against him and wanted to curse Israel and follow other gods. Judges 3, Eglon, the king of Moab, comes and conquers part of Israel. And God sends a judge, Ehud. I can't help but remember a song that we have about Ehud. It says that he came to Eglon and said he had a message from the Lord, and he gave him 16 inches of sword. He killed the judge Ehud killed the king Eglon of Moab and delivered Israel from them. Then they show up again in 2 Kings 3. Now we're getting close to the time of Isaiah now. 2 Kings 3 is about 100 years before Isaiah. Mesha, the king of Moab at that time, started conquering these cities up north of him. And he actually claims to have come all the way into Jerusalem and conquered cities along in here and taken vessels out of the temple of God and carried them down to his god Chemosh to worship to worship Chemosh using God's instruments from the temple. Well, the kings of Israel and Judah at the time didn't want to put up with that, so they allied together with the king of Edom, and they came around south of the Dead Sea and up into Moab and put the kibosh on King Mesha's plans. If you'll remember how the story went, the allied armies were thirsty. There wasn't much water in this part of the land, and so the prophet... Elisha tells them to dig trenches. The trenches get filled up with water, and that provides water for the troops. The Moabites see these trenches of water with the morning sun coming over them and say, oh look, there's blood all over the place, they must have all killed themselves, and so they rush forward unarmed to see what's going on. And then the renewed Israelites and Edomites come in and slaughter them. So that is kind of the history of Moab to date. Some of the things that we're going to see in this passage are the high places. It mentions Dibon or Dimon, which is just up north of the capital city, just north of the river, where there's hilly country. You can go up to the top of those hills, and they would have altars to Chemosh, their god of Moab. So that's what we see in chapter 15, verse 1, as they're going up to weep and wail and worship. It's also noted in chapter 16. Now then, their problem, though, was pride. If you look at chapter 16, what is it that I... Okay, well, chapter 16, verses 6 through 12. We have heard of the pomp of Moab, very puffed up, his pride and his pretentiousness, his boasts are not true. Therefore, Moab will wail for Moab. Everyone will wail. You will mourn, utterly stricken, for the raisin cakes of Kir Hareseth. For the fields of Heshbon languish, and the vine of Sibmon. The lords of the nations have struck down her branches. They reached to Jazer and wandered to the desert. Her shoots spread abroad and passed over the sea. Therefore I will weep with the weeping of Jazer, the vine of Sibmah. I drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Elalah, for over your harvest time and your harvest crop the shout has fallen off, and the joy and gladness are taken away from the fruitful field. And in the vineyards it's not sung out, it's not shouted. The treader will not tread out wine in the presses. I have put an end to the shouting. Here we have people that are proud. They're arrogant, boastful. What are they boasting about? What are they arrogant about? One of the main things that it mentions is their food production. They're proud about their grapes and what they can produce from their own, the works of their hands. They think that it's their own work, or perhaps that it's their own god Chemosh that has given them these blessings. That is pride, to think that anything good we have is the result of our own efforts and labors. Everything good comes from God. I mentioned a minute ago this king from 100 years before Isaiah's time, Mesha. He actually set up a monument for himself. And I'm going to pass a photograph of it around both sides. It's the same, both are the same. This was discovered, this was carved in the 600s B.C. So it's about 100 years before Isaiah. I'm sorry. Well, okay, it's dated to around the time of Isaiah, but if we correspond that with the Bible records, we can get it more specifically to about 100 years before Isaiah. That king wrote down this boastful message on here. You can read the text of it on the second page. But I will read a little bit of the text to you. He said, "In Karak, I made this high place for Chemosh." That's their idol. "Because he has delivered me from all kings, and because he has made me look down upon all my enemies. Omri was the king of Israel, but I looked down on him and on his house." Is that proud? He's looking down on everyone. "Chemosh said to me, 'Go, take Nebo from Israel.' And so I went in the night, and I fought against it from the break of dawn until noon, and I took it. I killed its whole population. The word I is just over and over and over and over again in this thing. I. That's a sign of pride when you have eye trouble, when you're saying the word I a lot. I killed its whole population, several thousand male citizens and aliens, female citizens and aliens and servant girls, for I had put it to the band of Ashtoreth Chemosh. And from there I took the vessels of Jehovah and hauled them before the face of Chemosh. Pride. This is the downfall of Edom, of Moab, their pride. How much better if we're going to boast in the Lord. In the book of Jeremiah it says, "Thus says the Lord, let not the wise man boast in his wisdom, let not the mighty man boast in his might, let not the rich man boast in his riches, but let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me, says the Lord. I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth. In these things I delight, declares the Lord." God says, don't boast about your wealth or your strength or your wisdom. Boast that you know God. That is what we should boast about. That's what we should tell other people about. When we want to impress someone, impress them by telling a story about how great God is. And so we have fulfillment and of this, well, the judgment that God gives against Moab and the fulfillment of this prophecy. God hates pride. And so we have this burden that comes. And I'm going to just read, start with Isaiah 15:1 and read through that chapter. The burden of Moab. Because Ar of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. Because Kir of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. These two capital cities in one night. Undone. He has gone up to the temple, up to Dibon, to the high places for weeping. Upon Nebo and upon Medeba, Moab wails. On every head is baldness, every beard is shorn. In his streets they wear sackcloth, and upon her housetops and in her squares everyone wails, melting down in tears. And Heshbon and Elalah cry out, their voices heard as far as Jahaz. Therefore the armed men of Moab shout, his soul trembles within him. My heart will cry out for Moab. Her fugitives will be as far as Zoar, three-year-old heifer. I'll just pause there to explain. That's a very confusing passage, and different people translate it different ways. Some people translate that just as a proper noun, something Shilashia, I can't remember exactly. It seems to be come with good authority. This concept of a three-year-old heifer is a cow that has never been yoked before. It's just beginning to reach maturity, but has never had to actually carry a burden before. And so this is kind of a term of pity. These poor people, they've never borne the yoke of God's judgment, and now suddenly it's being thrown on them as they're fleeing southward from their country. From the ascent of Luhith, they'll go with weeping. From the road to Horonaim, they'll raise a cry of destruction. The movement here is people who are up north going south. Luhith is down here, Horonaim is down here, and they're all heading down towards Zoar, towards the border, to get over the river into Edom. They're escaping from an army who's advancing down from the north. It goes back to some of these northern places. The waters of Nimrim will become a desolation. The grass is withered, the vegetation fails, the greenery is no more. That's up in the north. An army has stopped up rivers just like they did earlier at a time when there was an invasion of Israelite forces earlier. They stopped up rivers in order to overcome Moab. And it sounds like that's what the Assyrians are going to do again. And so the area dries out once the rivers get plugged up. They can't grow their grapes there anymore now. Therefore, the abundance it made and the stores they and their stores, they will carry over the Brook of Willows. That's the Zered River, the Brook of Willows, down at the southern boundary. They're going to carry all their possessions as they're running south to escape from the country of Moab. The country is going to be emptied as people are fleeing. The waters of, a cry has encompassed the border of Moab, her wailing even to Eglaim and to Beer Elim. Eglaim was these far north and Beer Elim far east. The waters of Dibon are full of blood. I will set upon Dibon, adding on, a lion to the escapees of Moab and to the remnant of the ground. There's blood in the river. People are being slaughtered by the advancing army. That army would be the Assyrians, if they were going to be coming in, it says, 3 years. What a terrible, horrific judgment is coming on these people for their pride. It's the last verse, Isaiah 16:14. Says the same sort of thing. Now the Lord has spoken, saying, in 3 years, like the years of a hired worker, the glory of Moab will be brought into contempt in spite of all his great multitude, and the remnant will be very few, not many. The idea of 3 years, like the years of a hired worker, if you hire a man to work for 3 years, he's going to be counting the days, and when he's done, he's done. You're not going to get a day more labor out of him. And that's the idea. It's going to be exactly 3 years before this happens. The lion that's promised to be chased after them could be actual wild lions. Some people think that God did send lions into the country of Samaria. Right about the same time period as this, when the Assyrians had conquered Samaria and they started resettling other pagan peoples into Samaria, and so God was no longer being worshipped there. God sent lions into the country, and the king of Assyria said, "Whoa, what's going on here? We better get some of those. It must be that the local god isn't real happy with what we're doing," so he imported some Israelite priests in order to shore things up there. Maybe that's what happens down here. As the people are fleeing south, wild lions are killing them. Another way to interpret it is the lion being Nebuchadnezzar. The Bible does mention Nebuchadnezzar in the figure of a lion. And there were lions that were used to represent him in some of the Persian architecture. But whatever the case, there's going to be a double whammy. The Assyrians are going to be destroying the people of Moab, and there's going to be another destroyer, whether maybe wild lions, but certainly Nebuchadnezzar did come later and wipe them out. But notice that there will be a remnant, both at the end of the chapter 15 and at the end of chapter 14. It speaks of a remnant. Verse 15:9, a remnant of the land. You see that? The last verse in chapter 14, the remnant will be very few, not many. Now, this is in contrast to what we just looked at last week about Babylon. They were to be utterly wiped out. There would be no remnant of Babylon. But here there's still mercy for Moab. I found an interesting archaeological piece that may speak of this remnant. In the town of Medaba, there is a mosaic that was built somewhere between Isaiah's time and our time, about halfway in between. This is about 600 in the 600s A.D. And I will pass around pictures of that. It's got, the mosaic has been destroyed over time, but you can see the, okay, yeah. You can see the, you can see what there is of it with the Jordan River coming through here and the Dead Sea here, Moab on this side and Jerusalem on this side. I'll just pass around a copy so that you know these are both the same. And there's another map where I'll orient you to what you're seeing. But this map was developed by Christians in Moab in the 600s. And it was developed as a map for pilgrimages so that people who love the Lord and who are followers of Jesus could get oriented to going to some of the sites around the Holy Land and remember Jesus and what he did in these different places. I think this may well be a fulfillment of this prophecy of a remnant in Moab. Not only a remnant just in terms of some physical people left, but people who would be worshipers of the one true God and who would follow Jesus when the good news came to them. What a contrast this is, the humble pilgrim's map, map for people on pilgrimages that points to the glories of what God had done in Israel. What a contrast from the other archaeological artifact that I passed around, that mesh of steel with its proud boasting words and looking down upon Israel. What a contrast between the pride of Mesha and the humility of the Medeba mosaic. What can we learn from all this? What can we learn from all this? Pride creates some real problems. And I'm gonna highlight three things that pride does to us that hurts us, just like it hurt the Moabites. First thing, pride blinds us to the danger of God's judgment. Pride blinds us to danger. In chapter 15, in their pride, they're going to their god Chemosh, to their high places, to their idols to worship and to weep. They're blinded to the fact that God is bringing judgment upon them for their idolatry and their pride. They don't even realize what's wrong. And as they go north, they meet the Assyrians as they're invading from the north. Their pride blinded them to danger. In chapter 16, verse 6, his boasts are not true. His pride led him to believe things that were not true. He was boastful. Pride does that. It blinds us to the truth. And then we get smacked on the head when we run into what really is true. Sometimes when we're proud and we're thinking that we're great in some way, and then we get hit over the head because we realize we're not that great. There's a story about the king who was the king of the jungle, the lion, who was roaming around the jungles and around Africa. And he went up to the monkey and he said, "Monkey, who's the king of the jungle?" And the monkey said, "You are the king of the jungle." And the lion let him go and prowled on to the next place and then found a zebra. And he pounced on the zebra and said, "Who's the king of the jungle?" And the zebra said, "You're the king of the jungle." And the lion said, "Okay." And went off and he went to the elephant, ran to the elephant and said, "Who's the king of the jungle?" And the elephant picked him up in his trunk and threw him against the tree. And the lion said, "Well, just because you don't know the answer doesn't mean you have to be so rough." His pride blinded him to the fact that he wasn't the biggest and greatest. He wanted everybody to think he was the biggest and greatest, but he ran into that elephant and learned otherwise. Pride blinds us. 1 Corinthians 10:12, Paul warns us, let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. If you think you've arrived. If you think you've got it all right, if you think you're the best, take heed. Pride also, the second thing, pride blinds us to danger. Pride also keeps us from doing God's will. We have the two great commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And these are two things that are that the prophet calls upon Moab to do at the beginning of chapter 16. Let's look at that. Chapter 16. Verses, just go 1 through 5. Send a lamb, ruler of the land, from Petra, by the way of the desert, to the mount of the daughter of Zion. Okay, so here's, again, these people, the Moabites have fled south, and they're taking refuge in Edom, and Petra is the same as Selah, right down in here. Petra is that place, you've probably seen that fancy facade, rock wall facade that they built there that was in the last Indiana Jones movie. So they're down here taking refuge, and they're going to send and they're commanded, send a lamb up on the east side, up through this desert, up to Jerusalem, where the daughter of Zion is. And the lamb is to be a sacrifice to God. Like fluttering birds, like a scattered nest will be the daughters of Moab from the crossings of the Arnon River. Give counsel, make justice. Set your shade like night in the midst of daylight. Shelter the outcast. Do not reveal the fugitive. My outcast, this is God speaking, and different translations have this worded differently. This is another one that could be translated one of two ways. It could either be the people that are down there saying, let's send the lamb. The Moabites could be saying, let's send the lamb and tell the people in Jerusalem to give us some good counsel and to make justice and to shelter us and our outcasts. Or it could be God speaking to Isaiah to the Moabites saying, here's what you better do. You'd better worship the one true God by sending the sacrificial lamb to Jerusalem, because that's what God has commanded. That was the form of worship that they had in the Old Testament, to point towards Christ by sacrificing lambs. And you guys had better quit being unjust and create some real justice here. And when my people escape into your lands, you need to be hospitable towards them. My outcasts will sojourn with you, so be a shelter to them, Moab, from the face of the destroyer. I think it's best to take it the latter way. That this is God's command through Isaiah to the Moabites. And you see that the things that are commanded of them parallel the two great commands. Love the Lord your God. By performing this act of worship, sending the lamb to Jerusalem for a sacrifice, and two, love your neighbor as yourself. When my outcasts show up, be hospitable towards them. Love your neighbor as yourself. But their pride blinds them so that they do not do what God has commanded them to do. They are not going to worship the one true God, and they're not going to love their neighbor as themselves. And for that reason, in their pride, they will be judged. Similarly, we can, our pride can keep us from loving God and loving other people. When we're proud, it's very hard for us to love other people. When we're proud, it's hard for us to truly worship God, because worship is an act of humility. So pride blinds us to danger. Pride keeps us from doing God's will. And finally, pride keeps us from receiving God's blessings. When we think that the good things in life are due to our own work and our own smarts, our own wealth, our own strength, God will withhold blessings. Just like He did from Moab. Water was withheld from them. Their fruitful fields were dried up. Their fruitful fields no longer produced good crops. And it was no more raisin cakes for Moab. They could no longer enjoy the things that they had taken such delight in because they were not seeing those things as a result of God's blessing for them. Are there any ways that we do the same thing? That in our pride, we cut ourselves off from God's blessings? There's a story of a curator in the Freiburg Cathedral of Germany. He was an old man. He used to play the organ there. They had a fabulous organ in this cathedral, in the Freiburg Cathedral. This old man had gotten arthritis so bad he couldn't play the organ anymore very well. So he hired another man to play the organ. But it was such a special instrument that only he and the new organ player were ever allowed to play that organ. It was a famous place, though, so there were visitors that were constantly coming through. And one day a visitor came into the cathedral and asked to play the organ, and the custodian said, No, only the organist and myself. We're the only ones that are allowed to play this thing, because this is a very special instrument, and we just can't let everybody play it. Well, the visitor kept asking for permission. Finally, he did. He sat down and started playing beautiful music, and the curator was just enthralled and just, wow, this music is wonderful. I finally asked the man, well, what is your name? The man said, well, I'm Felix Mendelssohn. At the end of his life, the curator was heard to exclaim over and over again, I almost missed hearing Mendelssohn play my organ. Pride can cut us off from blessings. When we are willing to accept the blessings God gives us, that is what we want. That's what God wants of us, is to accept the blessings He gives us. And sometimes those blessings are not, they don't feel like wonderful things. Sometimes they are hardships. But everything, to receive everything as a gift from God, is a safeguard against pride. Finally, one other thing we can learn from this is that God has compassion in the midst of judgment. In chapter 15, verse 5, both of these chapters mention weeping. Verse 5, my heart will cry out for Moab. My heart, God's heart, Isaiah's heart, will cry out in the midst of this proclamation of judgment. They're crying. Why is that? Chapter 16, verse 9. Therefore I will weep with the weeping of Jazer. I drench with my tears. Why? Because God is a God of compassion. He's a God that even in the midst of judgment is compassionate. We see that with Nineveh. Even though Jonah came with his proclamation that 30 days and Nineveh will be overturned, behind that was God's compassion. And when Nineveh repented, God relented from the judgment. There is hope if you're proud. There is hope. There is time to humble yourself, to cry out for help to God and receive His blessings and find delight in doing His will.